Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. You all are the only case on our docket this afternoon for oral submission, and I understand you've spoken with our clerk and indicated the time you would like to argue. So if you all are ready to proceed, we will begin. Are you all ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Our clerk will call the case.
The court will now call Chase Karen Block versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. J. Jeffrey Springer will argue for the appellant. Mr. Matthew J. Lincoln will argue for the state.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, I'm Jeff Springer. I'm here with Aubrey Dameron. She's one of the associates at our firm who's assisted me with the case. We're here today because our client, Mr. Karen Brock, received a 60-year sentence for an aggravated burglary where he used a deadly weapon, but no one was hurt, no property was taken. This was his first felony offense. His only prior offense was a misdemeanor marijuana charge. And despite this, his sentence is several times more than the average sentence for a similar crime, both in this county and elsewhere in the state. We've made three arguments for Mr. Karen Brock. First, that his sentence violates the Eighth Amendment's proportionality requirement. Second, that the court abused its discretion by failing to properly apply the Eighth Amendment when determining Mr. Karen Brock's sentence. And third, that the trial court improperly doubled or tripled Mr. Karen Brock's sentence based on an unadjudicated offense that was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. We've made that in 6 points of error, but I'll address these three issues in my argument today. The first issue with respect to the Eighth Amendment begins obviously with the United States Supreme Court. There are two cases in which the Supreme Court has found that a sentence of years violates the Eighth Amendment. The first was in 1910 in a case called Weems versus the United States. Weems had committed fraud, but he was sentenced to 15 years of shackles and hard labor. The Supreme Court held for the first time that a sentence of years might violate the Eighth Amendment, and in that case specifically did violate the Eighth Amendment. Weems crafted a new vision of the Eighth Amendment that allowed courts to evaluate sentences based on the Eighth Amendment by using public opinion and contemporary moral standards of society. Unfortunately, the court didn't articulate a standard, and it was 70 years before the court spoke on the issue again. That happened in Solemn versus Helm, which is a 1983 case. In that case, Mr. Helm wrote a check from a fictitious account, and that check was a felony that amounted to his seventh nonviolent felony conviction. Under South Dakota law at the time, his mandatory sentence was life without parole. The court in that case articulated a three-factor test that this court would be required to use to evaluate Mr. Karen Brock's sentence. The first prong of the test compares the gravity of the offense to the harshness of the penalty. The second prong and third prong compare sentences for similar crimes in the same jurisdiction and those imposed in other jurisdictions outside the state. Justice Kennedy proposed a modification of the Solemn test in Homelin versus Michigan, and he proposed making the first prong a gateway. It appears to us that most Texas courts have adopted that, even though it hasn't been uniformly adopted in the federal courts. Under the modified test, the threshold inquiry only requires the court to determine whether there is an inference of disproportionality. In other words, the court doesn't have to base its gateway analysis on a finding that actual disproportionality exists, only that there's an inference of that. Now, my take on this is that the court may already be there, or at least part of the way there, because the court might recall that it abated this case on our request because Mr. Karen Brock didn't have a lawyer at a critical stage of the proceeding, and that allowed us to pursue a motion for new trial for him where we argued that his sentence was unconstitutionally disproportionate. I don't think the court would...
Did you argue to Judge Burgess that because we did that, that that somehow or another inferred that we thought his sentence was excessive? Because in reading his comments, it sounded as though that message was delivered to him. I think that reads in way more than may have been there. Do you not think
I agree, Judge, and I didn't intend for him to take my argument to mean that. What I did intend for him to take my argument to mean is that this court would not have sent it, anything back down to the trial court unless this court found harmful error. In other words, if this court...
But not have an attorney at an essential stage of the proceeding is harmful, is it not?
There are cases, and there are even Eighth Amendment cases, where the courts have looked at disparities in sentence and found, and one of them cited by the state in this case, that the fact that a finding was made that, I'm sorry, it's on the second issue in the case, which pertains to whether or not an extraneous offense can be used to increase a person's sentence, which, of course, is a due process violation if that's done under both Texas and federal law. Our Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has looked at that using a harmful error analysis, which is the same argument that the state makes here, is that the error in the court using that extraneous offense, even though it may have violated his Fifth Amendment right for due process of law, wasn't harmful because the facts of the case alone justify the 60-year sentence. Now, obviously, we disagree with that, but I think a court can use a harmful error analysis to determine whether or not a constitutional violation merits sending a case back down to the trial court. And I certainly didn't intend to put words in this court's mouth, but I did intend to make that argument at the trial court level, and if I was stretching it beyond what I should have, I apologize. We believe we get past the inference under the modified solemn test for several reasons, not the least of which is that if you do what the courts have required courts to do, which is look only at the defendant's conduct and the harm that was caused or threatened by the defendant, that in and of itself really doesn't justify a 60-year sentence. There's something wrong there. And you can't look only at the state's brief alone to know whether that harm existed. And I hope the court will actually take a look. Obviously, Justice Gabriel has taken a look at the record in this case. I hope the court will do that. Most of the state's citations to the record in this case where they discuss the offense itself and the record of that are citations to the state's opening argument. The record is not always consistent with that, and I made a long list of the inconsistencies that I intended to talk about. I'm not going to address all of those here, but there are some disparities there, not the least of which is whether or not Mr. Jackamonis, who was the victim in this case, feared for his life during this incident. One of the most significant things that happened is in the 911 call that he made immediately after the accident, he told the 911 operator that Mr. Cambrock wasn't here to hurt anybody, he was here to get his money. And when he was asked on the stand why he complied with Mr. Cambrock's requests or orders, he didn't say it was because he feared for his life. His answer was, well, that's what I was instructed to do. So there are some disparities there, and I think they merit looking at because that's exactly what the courts have said an appellate court needs to do to review the severity of a sentence. The other factor is this. The jurors were shocked by this sentence, and we entered into a stipulation of facts rather than have the jurors testify in this case because the trial judge kept postponing the motion for a new trial hearing. But once we were able to get the hearing, we were able to agree on what they would say. One of these jurors, Mr. Twitchell, actually sent a letter to Judge Burgess where he expressed shock at the sentence. Both of them agreed to appear and testify at the motion for a new trial hearing and testify that they were not only shocked, but a half a dozen or so jurors that stayed to listen to the evidence during the punishment stage were shocked by the sentence. And I think that's some evidence of what the community standard is in Denton County and in this appellate district. And it's something that the court should not disregard in getting, especially in getting past that first prong. Once you get past the first prong, we tried really hard to put on objective evidence that this sentence was disparate when compared with other sentences in this county and in this court and indeed across the nation. In fact, there was one case that that was actually in this court that we cite, Henry versus State, where a man entered a home with a gun, ransacked the house, took multiple electronics and personal items, stood over an individual pointing a handgun at her, and he received a 5-year sentence on 3 counts, all of which ran concurrently. Obviously, that offense is hardly any different from what we have here, maybe even more severe than what we have here, and there's quite a bit of disparity between 5 years and 60 years. We listed a number of other cases, too, that came out of the Second Court of Appeals. Some of those, if the courts looked at the record, are highlighted in black off to the side. The ones that are highlighted in black, virtually all of those involve a defendant with a severe criminal history or a sentence for a defendant who actually committed either a violent assault or a sexual assault during the commission of the other crime. Those are the only ones that are close to Mr. Karenbrock's sentence. The sentence is for, especially for first-time offenders, for a crime like this, on average, are certainly less than 20 years. I can make a good argument that they're less than 15. One of the jurisdictions we looked at was the federal courts. Obviously, there's an identical crime in the federal sentencing guidelines. We cite to that in our brief. The sentence under the federal guidelines would be less than 5 years for Mr. Karenbrock, and that's taking into consideration the extraneous offense that I want to argue about as well. There are two other Supreme Court cases that I think are instructive. One of them was Graham versus Florida. I'm not going to talk about that in my argument today for the sake of time. Suffice it to say, the reason I think it is instructive is because that's the case. It's different from this case because it's a categorical case where the Supreme Court identified a category of cases that would violate the Eighth Amendment as such. In this case is the specific sentence that was given to Mr. Karenbrock. However, what the court does talk about in some great detail is the differences between a younger person and a full adult. And they take great pains to say somebody young has different characteristics than those of us who are adults. And we talk about that in our brief. Let me turn now just for a second to the last couple of issues which regard this hotel incident. The law in Texas is pretty clear that both in guilt, innocence, and in punishment, in order for evidence to be material to the issues involved, the state has to prove those beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, it's also clear that the evidence is probably going to come in regardless of whether the standard's met. The question is, how can you consider it once it's in? And I think that's a big problem in this case. Now, the state wants to argue that that's really not harmful error. In essence, that's their argument. It's not harmful error because if you look at the facts of the offense itself, it justified a 60-year sentence. I don't think you get there for the reasons that I've discussed on my Eighth Amendment argument, but I don't think you have to look much further than the trial judge's own comments, both after the trial, during sentencing, and at the motion for a new trial. At the conclusion of both, this is what he says. After the trial, he says, I could have considered 20, 30 years, but for the altercation with the Kreck brothers. He also says, at the motion for new trial, I would have considered 20 to 30 years based on the facts that were presented just on guilt-innocence. So he's tacked another double or triple the sentence that he would have given just based on the facts that he heard in the guilt-innocence stage of the case. He's relying solely on this incident with the Krecks. And if you read the facts of that incident, I'm not saying Mr. Karrenbach's conduct was justified, but I am saying there's no evidence of an assault. There is no evidence that he struck anybody. He walked up, he was hit, he went to the ground. We believe Mr. Karrenbach's case merits another look at sentencing at the trial court level for these reasons, and I hope the court will seriously consider that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Springer. Mr. Whitten?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matt Whitten, and I'm here with the state. 60 years is right smack dab in the middle of the punishment range that Mr. Karrenbach faced in this case. He was facing 5 to 99. The jury was actually instructed on a lesser included, chose not to go with that. So this is a first degree felony offense, the highest range of punishment you can get in the state of Texas, other than, I suppose, for capital offense. And what the Texas Supreme Court says in Simpson and applying Solemn is where the punishment is within the statutory range, there's no inference of gross disproportionality. We don't get to these other issues because the punishment is within the range. And this court has written, I think, I don't, forgive me for mangling the name of the defendant, Aditurina. The trial court has essentially unfettered discretion within that punishment range. I want to clarify what the state's argument is here. It's not just that standing on its own, this offense is worthy of a 60-year sentence. It is, for reasons I'll get to. But it's, I think, paints an incomplete picture. It's a bit reductionist to take the trial court's words about the extraneous bad act, this basketball court incident, where the trial judge said, well, you know, I could have considered less, 20 or something, had it not been for that incident. He's not tacking on 40 years just because of, as punishment for an unadjudicated offense. What he's saying is that, okay, you're out on bond for a first-degree aggravated burglary offense. There's a set of rules you have to follow, and your conduct continues to show that you are committing or at least involved in some pretty serious violent stuff. There was testimony, and again, the state wasn't trying to prove up an unadjudicated offense here. There's conflicting testimony, but the state's trying to show Mr. Karrenbach was there and there was testimony about grabbing a lady's arm while she had the baby and running off and threatening to shoot these people with a gun. And the trial court even said, he did not find Mr. Karrenbach's own testimony about that incident credible. So we have to take into consideration that the state's argument is not just that it's, if the trial court shouldn't have considered it, it was harmless error. Our argument is, first and foremost, it was not error to consider that evidence in punishment. Look at the facts of this case. I'm a little confused by some of the statements factually that are being made, because Mr. Karenbrock purchased a gun in advance of this robbery using his grandfather's money to commit this this aggravated burglary. He drove by the house a number of times in preparation. He, in his mind, apparently it was over $60,000 that was in dispute, which is evidence that this is a premeditated crime, because it's a serious amount of money and something that he was pretty concerned about. He had multiple, as the trial court pointed out, he had multiple opportunities to back off and say, you know, mission aborted. But he didn't do that, even when he saw that there was a three-year-old girl in the home. Mr. Giacomonis, during the 911 call, yes, there's testimony that says, well, he wasn't here to hurt anybody. That's because Mr. Giacomonis cooperated with everything that Mr. Karenbrock did, and he pointed a gun at his head. And he went in, and he tied them up. He had zip ties in his backpack. This was a premeditated, violent crime. And the fact that nobody was physically injured is good, but it's not a credit to Mr. Karenbrock's goodwill in the situation. What it is it's a credit to, as the trial court evidently believed, a credit to the Giacomonis's complying with Mr. Karenbrock's demands. So I want to clarify that the trial court, having considered the testimony about the hotel incident, it's not error. We're not trying to prove it up as an offense. What the testimony was, and there was obviously conflicting testimony that the trial court did not believe, but that was evidence that the trial court took as part of an overall picture. If you read the trial court's words, he gave a very lengthy explanation, especially at the end of the motion for new trial hearing, where he said, this crime was violent and premeditated, and although I could have considered less, the other conduct, regardless of what that may have been, showed it was further evidence of Mr. Karenbrock's malevolence in this underlying offense. So it was not error to consider that.
One of the things you started out on that I wanted to ask appellant's counsel is about as well is you said one of the reasons that there was no error on the sentencing here is that the sentence fell within the range of punishment under the statute. Were you able to find a Texas case where a Texas court has reversed a sentence where the sentence that was imposed fell within the statutorily prescribed range?
No, and I believe I pointed that out in my brief, that I was unable to find any case where a sentence that fell within the statutorily prescribed range was reversed for gross disproportionality or some reason akin to what we're talking about here today. There was the appellant put forth evidence about at the hearing about similar sentences and other crimes and things like that. The trial court also is experienced. The trial court, the trial judge in that case, has been on the bench now for nearly a decade, maybe more. Tried plenty of cases, knows what kind of cases go on in Denton County, and in fact there was testimony and discussion of that on the record. The trial court even pointed out, hey, just last week somebody got 60 years in this court, and at least in the trial court's mind, felt that that case was somewhat similar, felt that a case down the hall had been similar. And the trial court explained, I considered everything. It's an incomplete picture to say that the trial court only tacked on 40 more as a punishment for an unadjudicated offense. That's not what happened. He considered everything, and this was properly considered as part of the picture.
Another point that appellant's counsel has brought out in his brief and here today is the fact that the defendant in this case was very young, and he's pointed us to two Supreme Court cases that seem to indicate that when imposing a sentence, that should be something that the court takes under consideration. What's your position on those two cases?
Well, first of all, I would point out that the trial court did consider that and even said on the record, I believe, I don't want to put words in his mouth, exact words, but considered the youth of the appellant and the fact that he does not have, before this case, any felony criminal history. My position on those two cases is that in this case, first of all, we don't reach those inquiries because we're within the punishment range. But yes, I think it would properly, if we do, then yes, of course, things are properly considered, like the defendant's age or anything really. I mean, the trial court should consider everything when handing down or deciding on a prison sentence, especially in a serious case like this one. The two cases that the appellant brings out where the Supreme Court has reversed on a gross disproportionality issue are egregious cases that are just nothing like this one. I think one is, you know, a hot check and a lengthy prison sentence for a $100 hot check. We just don't have that here. This is not analogous to a situation like that. We have a punishment that fell squarely within the middle of the punishment range. I just do want to point out one more thing with respect to the consideration of that basketball court incident. It's properly considered regardless of whether you want to call it an assault or what. There's conflicting testimony, Mr. Karenbach's testimony, Mr. Crutch's testimony, who started it, who threw a punch, did Mr. Karenbach even throw a punch? The point is not whether an assault was committed. The point is that Mr. Karenbach found himself in this situation and that there was evidence that he escalated it, he's the one that got involved in it, and that when push came to shove, he knew he was out on bond and he ran before the cops got there and threatened to shoot people when he was going to go to his car and shoot people. So that's properly considered by the court. And of course, an extraneous offense, an adjudicated offense, that would be different. You would need a judgment or something proving up that it was actually Mr. Karenbach. But that's just not what we have in this case. With that, I will have a seat unless there are no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitten. Rebuttal?
May it please the court, just briefly, a couple of things. I recall what the trial judge said about the verdicts down the hall and the verdict in his court, both of which were about 60 years, and both of which involved defendants that had criminal histories. The one in his court, I believe the man had sexually assaulted the woman there, maybe his ex-wife, and had either shot her or stabbed her, and he received a 60-year sentence. What the judge said was he knew about those, but he disagreed with them. And I understand that as a jurist, he's got an absolute right to disagree. What he doesn't have the right to do is to render a sentence that's disproportionate based on the Eighth Amendment. And in our view, that's what the evidence during the motion for new trial shows. Is that the evidence in this specific case is disproportionate. Now, with respect to this extraneous offense, actually, now that I've argued this, I almost wish we had made that our first issue in this case because I do think it's more important. I think we may have a disagreement with the state about the law. And the latest case I could find, and I'm no necessarily legal scholar, is Weiser versus State, 12 Southwest 3rd, 479. That's a Texas
Court of Criminal Appeals case in 2000. The court states, quote, evidence of extraneous bad acts and offenses may not be considered in assessing punishment until the fact finder is satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that such acts and offenses are attributable to the defendant. Once this requirement is met, the fact finder may use the evidence however it chooses in assessing punishment.
And why is it your position that it wasn't proved beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well,
perhaps as a party.
I'm sorry?
Perhaps as Mr. Karenbrock being a party to that assault. I know you're going to say he didn't throw a punch, but as a party.
Well, I think the only way, what the cases say, obviously, is if the offense, it doesn't have to be that he committed it. It could be that it's an offense that is attributable to him. But speaking of rare cases, I think it would be a rare case indeed where an assault could be, you could blame one party for an assault that was committed by another. Now, I know he walked up and started it. The evidence is pretty clear about that. But the evidence is also pretty clear about what happened afterward.
And wasn't there evidence that he said he was going to get a gun and shoot him? That the judge could have given weight
some credence to that, I guess, possibly. But I mean, there's no evidence. Obviously, he had a weapon there. It's just questionable. And then when you have that, plus you have the remarks that the state makes in the brief, which is, you know, not only did we not prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, we didn't try to do that because we thought the court could consider it in punishment anyway. That's not what the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals opinions say about that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, counsel. Would you give me that cite one more time?
It's HUIZAR versus State, 12 Southwest 3rd, 479.
Thank you, sir.
And I'll leave it at that. I very much appreciate, it's been a long time since I've been here, and I appreciate being back. I'm sorry that I stumbled over myself at the trial court level. I certainly didn't mean to put words in this court's mouth. Sometimes I do talk a little fast and get ahead of myself. But it's been great to be here again, and I hope you'll seriously consider our arguments for this young man. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Springer. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and our clerk will adjourn court.